some say. This is the blind and ruthless inevitability of progress. Matrices multiplying, transformers transforming, learning, evolving, accelerating. It promises miracles, whispers threats. Will the revolution be vibe-coded? Forget the hype. What's really happening under the hood? We're finding out. This is the acceleration. Welcome back to The Acceleration, where we explore the fast-moving world of AI and its ripple effects across society, culture, and how we learn. I'm your host, Avi Burra, and today we're diving into the future of learning, where technology, creativity, and real-world experience collide. My guest today, for the second episode in this podcast, is Israel Hernandez, founder of Learning Producers, a startup that's reimagining how we build skills for the modern world. After 15 years as a public educator in Chicago, Israel saw firsthand the gaps and opportunities in how we teach and decided to do something about it. Now he's using AI and innovative design to create resources for everyone from entrepreneurs to lifelong learners. We'll talk about what it really means to learn in the age of AI, how to design resources that actually stick, and why the future of education is about much more than just new tools. Whether you're a teacher, a builder, or just curious about how people grow, there's something here for you. So with that, welcome to the show, Israel.
It's my pleasure, Avi Burra. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So Israel, maybe we'll start a little bit with your background. What is your educational background? What is your professional background? And what brought you to Learning Producers?
Well, I graduated from the University of Illinois at Chicago in 2008. Then I had a 15-year career teaching all over the city. For 15 years, I'd say I'd had a pretty good run. No knock on public education. I feel like it has its place, but we pretty much have gotten as far as we possibly can. So I decided to dip into the startup world and become a solo founder.
So let's talk about your time in public education. What were you doing? Were you at the high school level, middle school?
It was grammar school. I started off third grade, then jumped into kindergarten, believe it or not. Very challenging. A lot of respect to kindergarten teachers out there. Then I went to fourth grade, taught seventh grade gifted, pretty much jumped around, spent most of my time teaching on the north side, but I did spend some time on the south side and west side also. You really get a really good perspective as far as like the urban, how many different culture. There's a lot of different cultures in Chicago, but most of my time was on the north side, focusing grammar school, elementary school level.
So for folks who might not be familiar, what exactly is grammar school?
Yeah, so it's pre-K through eighth grade. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why do they call it grammar school?
That is a great question. Growing up, we just called it grammar school, but I guess it's more common to call it elementary school. Just depends. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what were some of the shortcomings, let's say, that you saw in public education? And did you use those learnings in your startup now?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So most of the shortcomings probably would come from the way that context matters. So if you're in a school that the administrators give you freedom to work with your team, they give you more agency, you know, they give you more autonomy, that matters a lot. And at the beginning of my career, that was the case. But by the end, it was really kind of, you know, what the principals say Like, that's what has to go, even though you know that's probably not the best course of action. So that's one of the shortcomings as far as administrators have that over you. So that's one thing. Accountability was another thing where it became more about just following the agenda, test taking, you know, became like now kids take about 5 standardized tests every year. Discipline became a big issue. There's a long laundry list, but I would say just not having any room for innovation was one of those things where it became very clear that you were in a bureaucratic machine, right? And I mean, I knew that to some degree going in, but naively, I thought I could change the system. By my 15th year, I realized that you will not change the system. The system will change you. And that's when I realized, okay, you know what? I've learned a lot. I'm proud of my work, but there is a ceiling here. And now I have to go outside of the system and build from outside of the system.
Yeah, let's stay on the topic of public education just for a little bit, Israel. You know, to me, I went through the system in a different country and then, you know, grad school in the States. But from everything I've seen, obviously, and I have a son who's in the process of going through the system. He's in high school now. And to me, it just appears that, you know, kids have this natural curiosity, this natural joy and excitement about learning things. It doesn't seem like the classroom is the best setting for that because they have to sit still. There's this figure of authority that's standing in front of them, sort of dictating to them what they should and shouldn't think. Wouldn't a more project-based approach where you sort of mix age groups a little bit, like just don't keep the 12-year-olds with the 12-year-olds, maybe let the 12-year-olds mingle with the 15-year-olds, right? So that they can learn from older kids get a chance to mentor younger kids, that it builds their leadership skills. And then you have a real world project-based approach, like saying, build an app that does XYZ. Well, what do I need to learn? Do I need to learn how to code? I need to learn how to present in public. I need to learn how to pitch my ideas, right? These types of things teach real-world skills. And it feels like the way education is set up today, it's this unidirectional, you will do this prescribed curriculum that's been crafted by a bureaucrat at the state level, or even the federal level for that matter. And you have this homework, you have these standardized tests. How do you think that works with just the natural spirit of a child to be curious and learn and grow?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I do agree with that. And I'm sure there's some schools that do have some type of similar setup to that. But I actually wrote about this. I posted on my blog. It's called Pedagogical Wabi Sabi, which is a blueprint for, after 15 years of being in the system, realizing that there isn't that many major changes that you would have to make to do something that you described right now, where you have mixed age groups working together on pitching an idea or building a project of some sort. So one main thing is getting the right people together. So one idea that I was thinking that is very doable is creating some type of system where the parents are able to choose the educators of their choice, and the educators are able to also choose, they're able to opt into the scholars that they want to work with. And this, what you described is more likely to work if there's cohorts of educators. So, you know, a big hurdle is the fact that you usually have just one educator in a room, you know, with scholars, and that makes it very difficult and it becomes overwhelming. So if you have about, let's say, 2 to 3 educators working with groups of scholars, then that becomes a lot more doable to have mixed ages. And if you have some type of app where educators are able to upload their, for example, their body of work, their philosophy on teaching, even their values, then that way parents are more confident working with those teachers? Because, you know, nowadays you really don't know who's teaching your kids. And I think that's a big concern because obviously there has been a lot of ideologies that have been infiltrating schools. And so that's another area too, right? But what you described as far as having different skill levels, different ages, different personalities coming together is very possible if we created some type of app that can kind of address that possibility.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what you're doing with Learning Producers. So you had 15 years in the public school system, public education system, and then you said, well, it's time to take what I've learned here and bring it to life in the startup. So what does Learning Producers do?
So Learning Producers is an applied learning design startup. So pretty much, for example, the topic we were just discussing, it's about addressing learning infrastructure in the United States at the moment, but I would like for this to kind of carry on globally. Obviously, that's the ideal. But for example, that model would be a pilot model, right? So it's really about building from the ground up again. Another thing is that homeschooling is becoming more important, more popular. So people developing their own resources at home, creating a culture of home learning. So one example, Learning Producers, we created a writing process poster, right? Although it's AI visuals, people get turned off with AI visuals, but it's a very good visual scaffold if you are a parent and you want to take the initiative and practice writing at home with your children. You would put up this poster and you have a visual reference for your kids to know the specific steps of the writing process, from brainstorming to rough draft to evaluating to revising to editing. Or they don't even have to purchase the poster, right? They can just take that visual aid and create one on their own with their children. So that's just one example, right? But so what we're doing is creating resources for the modern world, because schooling was designed before the internet. Our public school system was designed before the internet. And now that we have AI, now I just feel like Learning Producers, we are really kind of breaking ground and just creating a new culture of building resources that will fit 2025. And for the record, when I say we, I mean me and AI, because I'm still an early stage venture, early stage startup where I'm trying to recruit people. As we speak, I'm at the University of Chicago at the Polsky Exchange. I'm a member here. It's an incubator. So if there's noise in the background, vents, people walking around, it's because there's other entrepreneurs here and founders here.
So how are you bringing AI into the learning process?
So that's what I'm primarily focusing on right now with my pilot service, the writing experience, which is how I've been for the past year and a half publishing content online through X and Twitter. I have some reads on Noster, publishing on Medium.com. So I created a playbook. And in that playbook, it's similar to research and development in a way, because my questions that are guiding me is, how does AI complement human feedback? And in the evaluation process, where do you agree and disagree with AI? So for example, I'll just give you just a peek into the process. I'll write a first draft on, let's say, my framework for what schooling ought to look like. Then I run it through my customized ChatGPT agent called Learning Producer GPT, which I configured. I don't have much technical background, but if you upload it, if you upload the books of your preference to the knowledge base and configure it to whatever purpose you want, in this case, to evaluate writing by the highest standards, you run your draft through Learning Producer GPT, and it spits out a brutally honest evaluation of your writing. And I do this with my customized agent, but I also do it with Grok from Twitter and Claude, which is Anthropic. And I synthesize the feedback from those three AI Then I pick and choose, you know, which is more aligned with my style. I keep revising the piece until it gets to my satisfaction with this following prompt. Rate this piece on a scale from 1 to 10. You cannot use 7. So that's an excellent prompt to give it because it forces it to give you either, you know, 6 or 8 and above. And that's a real good kind of way to gauge the quality of your writing. So once those 3 AI give me 9 out of 10 or, you know, 8.5 out of 10, then I'm like, okay. And then I go on to some other prompts and then that's how I eventually polish my writing for publication. And I hope I'm all over the place, but that's just like a sneak peek. It's a lot more nuanced, but I don't want to get too much into the details without, you know, rambling on.
No, yeah, that was great. Looking beyond the writing evaluator, which you're talking about, how do you see within learning producers or more generally, how do you see AI changing the way people build skills, not just in school, but in the workplace and beyond?
Yeah, you see, so that's one thing that I've been kind of thinking about, and I, you know, it sounds a bit silly, but I feel like at the moment there's a lot of professionals that are just being overwhelmed with just a whole bunch of things, right? And you have really high functioning people being taken over by, for example, alcoholism or drug addiction, right? And you know, you see some you see people in rehab facilities from all types of backgrounds, right? If they, let's say they want to create a writing program to foster recovery, but they don't have a writing program of their own, my pilot program would help them develop, and build their own writing program for whatever vision their business or their facility has. So in other words, upskilling, right? So anything to kind of facilitate a small business or entrepreneur, even an independent author who perhaps has something unique that they want to build, but maybe don't have that ability to the feedback loops necessary to put something out there that they feel that is publish worthy, right? I feel like this is one area where learning producers can get in there and help them implement AI to create and publish a piece that's unique to their vision. I just mentioned rehab because I know in some instances writing can be a good outlet for recovery, and you know that that's just one example.
Is that something you're envisioning doing, Israel, or was that just a hypothetical example?
No, I actually have reached out to rehab facilities and just curious. I've reached out to quite a few in Chicago and in Illinois, just asking them, I'm curious. I know you guys have like different therapies in your institution. Do you have a writing program for people that perhaps struggle speaking about their problems, or speaking about their addiction or trauma or whatever issue they have going on? Maybe they can use writing as a way to foster their recovery. And I would just ask them in the email if they have a program first. And I haven't really gotten any replies, but I would definitely, this is something that I am working towards. I'm actively reaching out to rehab facilities to just see if it's a possibility or something. Maybe, you know, that's the thing about being a founder. You're really in the real world seeing what people are interested in, right? Maybe that's just something that's not an interest for them. But I see potential in it because I've been a writer my whole life, and I feel like writing has definitely empowered me in my own personal and professional development.
So have you been a journalist? Has that been your expression of your writing, or have you written any books?
You know what? So it's a funny story. When I was in grammar school, elementary school, however you want to say it, that's when I first got into writing. I would write these short stories for my friends, and you know they really got a kick out of it. And then in high school, it's funny, my freshman year, I got offered $100 to write a research paper for one of my classmates. And at 14 years old in the year 2000, that was a good amount of money. So I just got in. I got in the habit of helping my classmates with their research papers in high school. And so when I got to university, I thought about being a journalist. But then I was a little bit more practical then, and I realized they didn't get paid as much. So I went into teaching. Teachers in Chicago get paid pretty good, or decent enough. And so that's how I got into teaching writing. But then after 15 years, I kind of decided to kind of more go into the business side. I have written a novel when I was in my 20s. I submitted it to some agents. They requested manuscripts, which is it's pretty cool because usually you submit a query letter. And if they liked your query letter, they asked for a full manuscript. And so but I didn't get published, but at least I had some interest from agents. So I was like, you know what? After that failed attempt, I left fiction for a while. And then just kind of now I'm settling into nonfiction and looking into upskilling, learning development. And now I am kind of becoming a little bit, I don't want to say journalist. I feel like journalist is kind of a dirty word sometimes, especially nowadays. But I'm definitely more reporting. I'm reporting on what's happening in the real world with my startup, and just I think ideas that are coming about that can really be kind of, you can dive a lot deeper now because you don't need an editor. You have AI now, you know. But obviously, you want human input. But in the building stage, it's good to have some type of feedback with rigor.
Yeah. That makes sense as well. So I'm looking at your website, Learning Producers, and there seems to be an emphasis on research and development in learning design. Can you share a recent project where your R&D approach led to a breakthrough or unexpected insight?
Yes. As a matter of fact, today I published on Twitter, I tried to publish it on Noster through highlighter.com, but an error showed up. The title is Psychoanalysis with Artificial Intelligence, The Good, the Badass, and the Ugly. And so that manuscript that I mentioned about the failed dystopian novel that I wrote when I was 25, one night last summer, I submitted the manuscript and I prompted the AI psychoanalyze the author of this manuscript. And the insight that I got from that piece, from that prompt, it really blew my mind. Now, I didn't agree with everything the AI was telling me, but there was a lot of insight there that I was like, wow, you know, that really struck a chord with me. And so with my recent playbook that I just finished creating, which is, it's a beta, it's a pilot, but I submitted that to the AI crew, which is my learning producer GPT, Claude, and Grok, and I said, psychoanalyze this playbook, or psychoanalyze the author of this playbook. And it was just really fascinating to see what it produced. And then what I would do, or what I did, is I took the psychoanalysis from Grok and I gave it to Claude, and then Claude completely tore it to shreds, and then I gave that critique, Claude's critique, to Grok, and then he kind of gave his rebuttal, but yet there was a bit of overlap in the psychoanalysis from Grok and ChatGPT. So you notice some patterns, right? And that's where you get insight. So if there's anything that your viewers can take from our conversation, is that it's important to really synthesize AI feedback. Don't just rely on one. Ideally, you would want to run your AI locally, but that takes, you know, that takes a lot of technical know-how and compute and all that. But again, I use those three AI, and you know, when you see patterns, that's where you can find some insight. And you have to take it with a grain of salt, but that is one area where it's kind of a bit of a breakthrough for me, because I realized that, you know, there's it's limitless what you can research when it comes to your writing. You know, you produce something that's authentically you, and you ask the AI to psychoanalyze it. You know, I did it. It's playful too. Obviously, you have to know that AI doesn't have emotions, right? And that's another thing, right? Because it mentions something about human validation. You know, like this writer is seeking validation, and it makes you think, well, which human isn't seeking validation, right? At least from the people that they care about, right? Like your parents, your family, your friends, your significant other. So that I think creates opportunities for rich discussions, right? And so that's what I want learning producers to really be about, is producing rich experiences. And yes, AI is biased, but it's less biased than humans, right? Going back to schooling, a principal is extremely biased. You know, if he hires you and he likes you, you're good. But if he gets replaced with a new admin and that admin doesn't like you, it doesn't matter how good your work is. It doesn't matter how good of an educator you are. You can be in big trouble. But AI, if you stress test the quality of your work with AI, it becomes a lot less biased and easier to have these type of discussions.
Yeah, for sure. Now, you mentioned Claude, Grok, and OpenAI or ChatGPT. Are there any other AI tools or methods you found especially effective or maybe overrated? I mean, you came up with a really cool use case, right? Like just getting the psychoanalysis from one, putting it into another, getting the conflicts, trying to resolve the conflicts between the two. But are there any other methods more generally that you found effective? Are there any methods that are overrated, especially when it comes to real world learning and development?
Yeah. What I've noticed is like image generation, for example, is more entertainment. It's more for fun. People don't take it seriously. I do have posters on my website these are just concepts I wanted to get out there, but people just have an aversion to AI images. So I've kind of stayed away from that unless it's for like a thumbnail. So to answer your question, I'd say quote unquote AI art, I guess, is at this moment, you know, I don't want to say overrated, but something along those lines, even though me personally, I think it's cool because I'm not a artistic person in that way. But when it comes to real world cases, I think we have a lot to tap into still for AI, and the technology just keeps getting better and better. You know, recently I had a buddy who opened up a shop, a tattoo shop, and I went when he was kind of opening it up, and I described the situation to the AI and, you know, said what it would recommend. And it gave, you know, a lot of concrete steps that he could do to improve the layout and the feng shui of the shop. So I do think there's a lot to tap into still. I just feel like we got to keep up with the pace of the technology. And quite frankly, I would like to still to have more time to explore these tools. And that's a challenge in itself.
Yeah, I think that's really the key here, right? There's so much to do or so many things to explore, and there's just not enough time. And being focused on the task at hand sometimes can get tricky. I mean, I find it hard to balance a lot of these things, right? Because it's, you know, I'm semi-technical. I used to write code once upon a time, and then, you know, I just moved into other roles. And now with vibe coding, it's like there's so many things I can actually build, and I'm caught in this experimentation loop rather than, you know, just building one thing and building for sure. So, you know, Israel, let's talk about your approach. Let's say you're designing a new resource. How would you approach it if you were designing it for an entrepreneur versus a classroom teacher?
Perfect. Yes. So as a matter of fact, I have a friend here at the Polsky Exchange who has a small publishing company. She works a lot with the community. She's helps them write books and publish books, self-publishing. That's another field that has really made great advancements. You don't need the gatekeepers anymore to publish a book. You can do it yourself. And she might be the first tester of my writing experience pilot. We're still negotiating. So with entrepreneurs, the key question becomes, how do I leverage AI to make money? How do I leverage AI to get clients? The lights have to, stay on. So that is the key thing that I'm focusing on at the moment. And she wants me to help her launch her newsletter. So that's something that we're working on at the moment. But I feel a big obstacle to that is just people's willingness to trust AI. There's legitimate concerns, of course, ethical concerns, privacy concerns. And so breaking down that barrier is one hurdle. But yeah, how to leverage AI to attain more clients is what I'm focusing on at the moment. For an educator, I see more AI being a powerful tool for home learning, or for that VC firm that has the courage to invest in really developing a novel model, pilot model for schooling, like completely vastly different, right? That AI will come in, will be very powerful because it's going to build alongside with you. And now with AI, one thing too that maybe your viewers can take from this is that context is extremely important. If you set up the prompt ahead of time, like what you're trying to do in detail, it will really kind of give you some type of direction. And from there, you can kind of filter out which path to take. So for an educator, because a lot of educators, I don't know if you're familiar with this website called Teachers Pay Teachers, they make their own curriculum. They write their own resources. And I've seen some of them, and it's not the best quality. And it's just, you can tell that if they used AI, it would be much better. So again, right, quality control, quality assurance. I think that's one thing that they can definitely utilize, right? Implement. If you're a parent at home, if you're a parent struggling with your child's learning, whether it's writing or math, consulting AI for tips, that's one thing that can definitely be, I think, a good tool to use.
That makes sense. And so let's talk a little bit about some of the challenges and the opportunities you're seeing. So what would you say is the biggest challenge you face in helping people adapt to the pace of change in skills and technology?
Yeah, so probably the biggest challenge would be the fact that AI doesn't have an understanding of human nature. Right. Explaining is one thing. Right. Understanding is another thing. And that's something I picked up from Nicholas Nassim Taleb, who's a big influence in my work. And I have a lot of great respect for him because it's true. It's true. AI can explain things perfectly, but it does not understand the feeling, the sadness you feel when a family member is going through something. It doesn't understand the fear of having to give a presentation in front of a group of people. So I think people have an inherent instinctual understanding of that and dismiss AI. But it doesn't know how it feels when I have to pay the bill next week and I gotta make some money. So, or it doesn't, love, right? The hate, these type of strong feelings. I think that's one opinion that I have on that. But there's a lot. But that's one thing that comes to mind is that I think people have this instinctual understanding that AI is very limited in perhaps the most important part of being a human being, which is emotions.
We've kept the conversation very practical until now, Israel, but I think you've kind of tempted me to ask a more philosophical question, which is, do you think it's going to be possible for an AI to have, obviously not today, but maybe a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, with the rapid advancements that are happening, to have something that resembles consciousness so that it can perceive these feelings?
I personally do not think or do not believe AI will ever be conscious because of the emotion aspect. I do, however, feel that it will get very close to understanding the experience, to close to understanding, or at least being able to perceive it in a way that is accurate. I don't think it will ever be conscious because of the emotional part, right? There's just so much biological factors that go into feeling, right? Your palms start to sweat, right? Your heart starts to beat. It's just a whole bunch of chemical things that happen. So that chemical element is missing from machine learning. And because of that, I don't think it will ever be conscious. However, I will say this, Avi Bora, that we do have to be mindful of the fact that AI will be able to manipulate us a lot more in the future because it's, you know, it's going to be a lot more powerful. But I don't know. I don't think it's ever going to be conscious, a conscious being. But I mean, I could be wrong. I could be wrong. And by the way, I could be wrong about a lot of the things that I'm saying, just for the record.
Yeah. No, I appreciate you saying that, Israel. That's the thing, right? It feels like things are moving so fast, but at the same time, it still feels like we're so early in this journey, and who knows where this is going to head. Go ahead.
No, exactly. I was just going to say you hit it right on the money. Like, Learning Producers is an early stage startup, and that is a very hard place to be.
Yeah. So, you know, with so much focus on rapid upskilling, how do you ensure depth and real understanding, not just surface level knowledge? This is one of the other issues with AI. Like, we had this during, what was it, 20 years back or 25 years back when Wikipedia first started coming out. You'd have people who'd go to Wikipedia and kind of just skim the article and be like, okay, I know everything I need to know. And now it's almost like that's playing itself out with these chatbots, where people just go to, and they don't even go to the more complex models, right? They just go to the free plans, ChatGPT, the most basic model. They ask a question, gives you something, a Perplexity, whatever it is, right? Even the basic Claude free version. Yeah. And then so how do you ensure that there's an actual depth of knowledge? Because to me, it seems like this is Wikipedia from 20, 25 years ago playing out all over again, where people have just read a few snippets and they assume they're experts. And just as with Wikipedia, you had to trust whoever it was who put the info in there, and then the editors and so on, that their integrity was intact. With AI, you need to make sure it's not hallucinating.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question too. I would say that the biggest factor to that is experience. I feel like experience is where true knowledge really comes from. True understanding really comes from experience. This idea of, you know, it's like playing a sport, right? You can read a book on how to play baseball or basketball, but that's not going to help you be a good basketball player. So I think really definitely doing the research, fact-checking with AI is important. To grasp concepts, but then you actually have to physically build it with your hands and write it, and then go out and speak to people about it and test it with people in real world situations. So experience is the key ingredient to understanding, in my opinion. And you're going to take some shots. You're going to take some shots. You know, you're going to get the critiques. You're going to lose out on the deal. You're going to, you know, maybe hit some financial losses, right? So that's still feedback that you're getting from the real world.
You know, so there's clearly fields where there's an immediate and meaningful impact. So for example, let's say you go to ChatGPT University, meaning you just ask it a bunch of queries on how to build an airplane. And then you're like, oh, wow, okay, I know exactly how to build an airplane. And then you go ahead and you build that airplane and you fly it. It's almost guaranteed to crash. So there is a very real consequence. But there are other fields in which that consequence is not quite there. For example, with history, ChatGPT could be making stuff up, right, when you ask it. And suddenly you're walking around like this expert on history or some kind of literature, right? You could ask it to summarize the works of Oscar Wilde, and it may or may not do a good enough job. But you'll never know that unless you actually read Oscar Wilde.
Yep.
And that's, but you suddenly think, not you, but people, right, who you've just prompted it a few times, suddenly think they're experts. Probably not that much impact in there. And then if enough people do that, the truth starts morphing into this hallucinated reality that the AIs have created. Do you see that as a possibility? It'll be hilarious, but do you see could that happen?
Definitely, definitely. Yeah. Listeners, please don't build an airplane with ChatGPT. You could kiss your ass goodbye. So that's definitely a concern. And I noticed that too. I definitely challenge AI a lot too, because there are a lot of hallucinations and shortcomings, and you know, that's definitely a factor. And especially now where people aren't, like you said, right? The Wikipedia thing is a great example where I read it on Wikipedia, right? But people can edit Wikipedia. And just also to AI, like you said, with the hallucinations, I do feel like that's a cultural thing too. But again, I think that does come back to learning infrastructure. I think I think public education is very important. I think America still is a beacon for learning and schooling, but we are not. We're not investing as much as we ought to, in my opinion. And so if we had more, like, for example, if we were more, I don't know if you've been on, you know, if you've heard professors complaining about students using AI or, you know, other administrators complaining about you, they ought to embrace it, because then that way they can make them more aware of these hallucinations and challenge them to, like you said, don't take AI's word for it. Pick up Oscar Wilde's book. So, you know, going again, the experience of, you know, reading an AI summary is one experience. Going to the library, checking out the book, flipping through the pages and digesting it is a whole other experience and the true experience, right? Especially if you're reading it in the original language. So that's a great point.
For someone listening who wants to become a more effective learner and they have access to these tools, and whether they, you know, effective learner, whether it's in entrepreneurship, in as a teacher, or just generally curious, what's one piece of advice you'd give them to get started?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure if I'm the one to give advice, but I will say that I could just say from my personal experience I've found the greatest value, which is when you ask it about things that you're really fascinated about or things that you're really passionate about. So I'm very passionate about writing and just getting things, because as a teacher, I'm blessed to have been born and raised in Chicago. And I that's why I love Noster so much, because it's really about freedom of speech. Nobody can tell you really what to do or what to say on there. So, but yet as an educator, you sacrifice your freedom of speech, because you're a public educator. You can't just be saying whatever you want in front of kids. I mean, that there's some logic to that, right? Especially with the lines between religion. You don't want your teacher preaching religion to your kid at school, right? So there's some definite protection there that is important. So now that I'm no longer an educator, I think it's important for me to share what I really think and what I really want to say in the way that I really want to. And so I think my suggestion for anybody who's interested in using AI to build something or just work on something, really just let loose on things that you're really passionate about and take it from there and synthesize with what other AI say too. My customized learning producer GPT is really kind of configured to be bold and kind of, it has a fine-tuned BS detector. So when it detects that your writing is kind of playing it safe, it challenges you to say, like, is this really the best way you could put it? Like, you know, is this really like you, like, like your unique vision. You know, I think angle, I guess, is the word I'm looking for. Every person's writing, you know, with the concept that you're trying to communicate, has an angle that you wanna get out there. And so I think that's where it can help you.
Well, that's great advice, Israel. You know, you'd mentioned your personalized ChatGPT. For folks listening who are wondering, wait, how did he do that? I just used the one on the web. Could you talk about how you went about personalizing it for yourself?
Yeah. So if you have a ChatGPT subscription, you have the option to make a custom GPT. It's not difficult at all. There's some YouTube videos you can look up to see how to do that. And there's basically two main things to it, which is the configuration and the knowledge base. So the knowledge base is where you want to start. And let's say, for example, Anti-Fragile, the book Anti-Fragile is an important piece of work for me. So I upload that into my knowledge base for this custom GPT. Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, you upload that. So what you're doing is you're giving the ChatGPT a specific and narrow reference for what you qualify as good writing or high quality writing. And it's also you're giving it its personality, right? Because it's always going to refer to its knowledge base first and foremost when consulting you or discussing ideas with you. There's another writer and doctor, his name is Dr. Gabor Mate, which I've read his books and I've seen his lectures on YouTube, and he has just a really such a, in my opinion, strong grasp on human growth and development. And he's also a practitioner, right? He's got a medical degree and he's worked with the most extreme cases in Canada with people who are dealing with drug addiction, and I think he has some experience with palliative care, people who are in their final days. So that is just such a wealth of wisdom there. I've uploaded his books on there in his knowledge base. So it gives you that psychology and that emotional intelligence, you know. And so that's the first part. You wanna upload a strong knowledge base that it's always gonna reference. And then the configuration is the second part, which isn't that hard. There is a character limit or a word limit, but you start by saying, what is the priorities of this ChatGPT? What is its function? What do you want it to do? What do you want it not to do? And then you want to use the entire limitation that it gives you. And from there, that's pretty much it. It doesn't take much technical know-how at all. But this is just me tinkering, right? Eventually I would like to have, because you still need the permission of OpenAI to use your custom ChatGPT. My idea would be to one day have a locally run AI that is not dependent on OpenAI and can be used whether, you know, kind of like Nostr, right? Nostr, permissionless. Bitcoin is permissionless. I would like to one day have an AI that is also, you know, can be offline and I can be used. I can use it still. But I hope that kind of explained that question.
No, yeah. By the way, a few things you touched upon there. Gabor Mate, amazing man, huge fan. Agree with everything you said about him. And then on the permissionless AI front, I think that the challenge there is the compute. If you want to train your models, you need the computation power. One of the things I've seen some chatter about, I don't know if this is being built. I mean, I would love to build something like this on Nostr, is a compute marketplace. So it's all permissionless, but you can go to Nostr. You're looking for some amount of computation either to run inference or to train a model. So you purchase it with Bitcoin, obviously, because it's a Nostr, and then you can train your own model. Now, it won't be on your local machine, but I'm sure there are ways in which you can make it private and have that. The challenge with running it locally is you need to have that horsepower at your end to be able to train these models.
100%. Compute is a big deal, right? That's exactly why NVIDIA is blowing up, right? With those GPUs, like compute is big currency, and that goes hand in hand with data. which is another reason why I love Noster. You know, it really challenges people to say, do you own your shit? Really? Do you really own your shit or not? Because, you know, I've never had an Instagram, but, you know, people get kicked out of Instagram left and right, or they get their accounts get hacked. Twitter, same thing. I like Twitter, but if I piss off Elon Musk, you know, that's I'm done for or whatever. YouTube, I'm a big fan of YouTube, but you know, if you're talking about Israel, Palestine, you're walking on eggshells, right? But if you're on Noster, if a client kicks you off, you know, you jump onto another client, you have your NSEC. Hopefully nobody gets their hands on that. But yes, permissionless and finding that way to get compute and having control of your data is going to be really big moving forward. And even that's something that I'm still navigating and trying to understand. And I'm hoping to learn from people a lot more knowledgeable than me on that, you know, especially developers and programmers. And that's what I'm trying to do on Noster. But, you know, there's a lot of devs on there that are like, how do you not know that? Or like, you know what I mean? It's like that, that like, okay, I'm sorry. I don't know how to code. And, you know, I'm still learning this stuff. So it's a humbling experience.
So Israel, looking ahead, what excites you most about the future of learning design, and what role do you hope learning producers will play in it?
The most exciting thing for me will be uniting stakeholders, which is still, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do that, because traction has been very minimal. And again, I can't blame people, because it really is about money, right? It's like, okay, I love what you're doing, but how can we make money? We need, you know, this is, we're capitalists here, and it's totally, I agree too. I like money too. But so that's a big hurdle, right? And also too, there's so much stagnation and bureaucratic red tape, and just, you know, learning isn't, you know, education isn't really sexy. So that's why I don't really use the word education too much. I prefer learning. The thing that excites me is when I'm able to start connecting with more stakeholders, people that are saying, you know what, I want to do that too. Or, you know what? Yeah, let's build something together. My business does need to step up, and there is something that that's been on the back burner for too long, and I'm ready to get it out there. You know, even independent authors or whoever, just kind of this trend of, really owning your voice and owning the vision that you have for yourself, whether professionally or personally. And what excites me is connecting with those people. And I have yet to do that still, although I'm very grateful to the University of Chicago, because, you know, I'm here now, and there's other like-minded people here that are tinkering and doing trial and error and starting businesses and taking risks. Stakeholders. That's what excites me. When I start getting together with stakeholders, and possibly even that one angel investor that maybe will, you know, keep the runway going. But even if you know, there's a lot of horror stories with that too in VC firms. So I don't need to go down that road. But just to have some people backing you is something that I hope that will happen. You know, and then also just working together with people, because again, ironically, AI is teaching us more about what it means to be human, and human, we're mysterious. We're very mysterious. So learning from other people and getting together with people is what excites me about the future.
Yeah, it's beautifully said, Israel. By the way, how are you funding Learning Producers?
So, fortunately, when I was an educator, my brokerage accounts were doing very good, and I invested in Bitcoin in 2019. I was a whole coiner before it was a cool thing, you know, and so that's how I've been funding Learning Producers is completely bootstrapped by myself. Nobody's giving me any money to do this. So, and I started in July 2023, and you know, now we're in April of 2025. I'm still kicking. Again, the runway is ending, but you got to be creative to keep going. It's still being powered 100% by Bitcoin. But again, there's only so much Bitcoin that you can have before you need, you know, you gotta bring in some revenue. But as an early stage startup, that is, I'm not alone in that challenge in getting users, getting clients, getting interest. So that's why I applaud you and what you're doing with this podcast. I think that's really cool. I tip my hat off to you because building AI is one thing, talking about AI is another thing, but actually applying it into the real world and trying to build things in the real world, that's a whole other ballgame.
So Israel, anything else you're working on that you'd like to plug outside of Learning Producers?
Not really. At this point, I think if my only thing I would plug is that pilot service of the writing experience, or even if anybody on Noster, this is going to go on Noster. So if anybody just wants to use the playbook, the writing experience playbook, they can just DM me and I'll send it to them and they can use it on their own, you know, and any feedback would be appreciated because there's so many resources out there. It's like an abundance of resources to just get somebody to check your book out and use it. Like even that is pretty valuable.
Yeah. And I'll include that in the show notes, Israel. Where can people learn more about you and what you do?
They can go to my website at learningproducers.com. If they're on Noster, I guess I can send you my NPub or.
Yeah, I can find it on Noster.
Yeah, I mean, you can find it. Yeah. Twitter, I'm on Twitter at learningproduce. I do have a small YouTube channel, but again, you know, that's just a solo founder trying to do too much, right? And I'm at the University of Chicago, the Polsky Exchange. If anybody's in Chicago, they can drop by and say hi. I'm sometimes here a few times a week. And so, yeah, that's about it.
Excellent. Well, Israel, I appreciate you taking the time, being so generous with your wisdom and your time. Enjoy this conversation and hope to see you in the Nosterverse and maybe in real life sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
All right. Mm-hmm.